until this mind finally becomes the simple instrument of humanity, by means of which man solves those problems which are essentially the problems of man. That he solves the mystery of health, of education, of labor, of policy, correcting crime and corruption, overcoming war and attaining peace. Therefore, that the mind is capable of correcting those ills which arise from the mind or from emotional tyranny over the mind. And by so correcting these ills, bringing man into a truly mental state, which is a state of order. Thus, a mind-directed society, if it is honorably directed, will be a smoothly running society. But the mind, so disciplined into order, becomes in itself a kind of restraint upon itself. And there is nothing that is less attractive to our contemplation than an intellectual world. A world run in an orderly way by a mental genius, acting as a superintendent over conduct, and perhaps even reaching the point in which its control is so great that man even loses the instinct to rebel against his own mind. This would produce the perfect archetypal intellectualist. The individual completely intellectually sufficient. But no one wants to be that person. Because, for one thing, something glamorous and beautiful is lost. Man really is almost like the Arab of the Arabian Nights. He would rather live glamorously than securely. He would rather have a dramatic existence with tragedy than a mediocre, monotonous one with perfect security. When it comes to actual living, man wishes glamour and drama. Now, this wish also has a place in his total makeup. His emotional life, like his mental life, has demands. The demand of emotion is for beauty, for color, for drama. The redeemed, enlightened, or directed emotions must therefore have in them no longer hurtfulness, but a tremendous intensity of satisfaction through the contemplation of their own most worthy instincts and impulses. The great musician, the great artist, is as important, if not more important, than the perfect intellectual. Now, the emotional life of man, coming into conflict with the mental, even on a very high level, we have two completely separate qualities. Qualities which, on the level of thought and emotion, do not and cannot comprehend each other. Mind can never experience emotion. And emotion can never experience thought. Man has a mysterious ability to experience the compound. But this is because there are dimensions within his nature which are not completely restricted by either mentation or emotion. If man was not in some way superior to both, he could not reconcile them in his own experience, nor could he share them and arbitrate them and mingle them almost as an alchemist might mingle the irreconcilable elements of fire and water. This brings us then to the next equation. And that is the relationship of the thought-emotion compound to something superior to and beyond itself. The Egyptians developed a very interesting philosophy by means of which they affirmed that all things can know or comprehend that which is less than themselves in the concatenation of universal order. But nothing can know that which is superior to itself. To know more than itself would require faculties greater than its own. To be more than he is, man must have become greater than he is. And you have the serious dilemma of trying to pick yourself up by your bootstraps or some other such inconsistent and unreasonable attitude. Therefore, if man possesses the power of consciousness, this power is not conferred by either mind or emotion. This power must have an existence apart from them. And if man is capable of reconciling thought and emotion, it is because in some way he is able to gain access to a power superior to thought and emotion, or to function upon a level above that of mind and intensity. The ancients held, therefore, that consciousness, which is the actual ability to participate in the experience of a thing, differs from mentation in one particular, that the mind approaches all things from the outside. Consciousness experiences all things inwardly, experiencing their inwardness with its own inwardness. Consequently, mind, like sensory perception, looks at. Consciousness looks into. And we are reminded, of course, of the familiar adage and statement made by the great Jewish philosopher, Rabbi Maimonides. This man pointed out that beneath the body, which inhabits the garments, is a soul. Beneath the soul, or within the soul, is a spirit. And he said this is also true of the law. For the body of the law is the Torah, within which is the Mishnah, or the soul of the law. And within this is the spirit of the law. And in all things, the letter of the law killeth, and the spirit of the law giveth life. Therefore, all things known inwardly become radiant or filled with light. All things known only outwardly are known by their appearances, their shapes, and the shells which conceal their true natures. Mind can intellectually recognize the existence of a life within bodies, but it cannot experience this. Emotions may feel or believe in the life within a body, but emotion of itself, untransformed and unregenerated, cannot experience this. Consequently, there has to be a dimension by means of which the experience of the inwardness of things and the universality of things may be available to man. The ancients, for the most part, assumed that consciousness, per se, was not a human attribute, that it was not a part of man, but that consciousness actually was the state of God. That what we call the divine nature differs from all lesser natures, inasmuch as the divine nature is the Noah, and subsists and exists according to the nature of being, having an essential substance, and having an eternal awareness of this essential substance. It does not necessarily follow that universal consciousness is aware of its own consciousness. Rather, we must assume that universal consciousness is an existing state, a kind of sea or ocean of life. That this consciousness pervades all things. That it is known only to itself, if at all. And that no other type of mentation or emotional cognizance can be directly aware of it except by judgment or rational extension. Thus the mind, as in the present moment while we are discussing together, is capable of assuming the existence of consciousness. It is capable also of fashioning an intellectual definition of consciousness. It is furthermore capable of rationalizing the absolute necessity for consciousness as the common substance and denominator of lesser states, the reconciler of all opposites, and a state of unity or totality without which the universe itself could not endure. Mind can therefore tell us of this, and by negative definition can convince us and assure us, even to the point of our own acknowledgement, that such a condition does exist, and that there is a being according to essence in nature, and that this being is different from all inferior beings because it is more than they are. It is therefore more than time, or it is eternity. It is more than parts, therefore it is wholeness. It is more than divided knowledge, therefore it is wisdom. It is more than the numerous virtues, therefore it is the good. It is superior to nature, therefore it must be part of the cause which engenders or generates nature. It is greater than man, therefore it is divine. These conclusions we arrive at, and from these conclusions great rational philosophies and religions have been built. And these rational systems are not bad, nor are they necessarily corrupt from any such conclusion or belief. If corruption enters into them, it is because they have departed from value, not because they have affirmed something greater than themselves. Yet, having achieved the intellectual recognition of all these things, having, therefore, the intellectual recognition of divine love as an aspect of universal consciousness, having the intellectual concept of divine wisdom as an expression of universal consciousness, having also the intellectual concept of divine power as an aspect of universal consciousness, we come, therefore, into omniscience, omnipresence, and omniactivity. And we also conceive that our ultimate allegiance is to this universal and supreme good, which our intellect seeks to embrace, and which our senses generate, clothing, however, always in the simpler terms of familiar things, so that we actually must use comparatively commonplace expressions, and in inwardly reflecting upon these great matters, we use trite symbols, which are utterly inadequate. Recognizing all this, we can then perhaps understand the difference between consciousness and thought. For thought gives us the power to recognize all these good things. Yet it does not give us a sharing in them. It does not cause these good things to awaken immediately within us. Nor does this thought fill us with such inevitable and ever-present admiration that we immediately depart from all else and strive after this sovereignty of good. Thus, believing in universal love, we continue to hate our neighbors. Believing in universal peace, we continue to precipitate wars. Believing in universal tolerance, we are still subject to religious and racial intolerances. Believing in the value of all spiritual matters over material considerations, we still desperately strive after material ends at the expense of conscience and character. This is because we can think about good, but this thinking does not give us the living experience of good by which it becomes more important than any other consideration and by which it is made to exercise an irresistible force upon our conduct. The only answer then is that in order to be moved dynamically from a common and ordinary procedure to an uncommon and unordinary one, there has to be some kind of an impact. This impact for man must be an extraordinary circumstance. And such an extraordinary circumstance is usually an experience of consciousness arising from catastrophe, from crisis, or from some tremendous revolution within the temperament of the individual. The moment that an experience of consciousness takes the place of a mental concept, the individual becomes identical with his objective. He does not contemplate it, he is it. He is not given any longer the privilege of deciding which is better. For in the experience of the best, all else becomes unimportant. Consequently, our deepest philosophies have always impelled man to search for the experience of consciousness by means of which a totality or a synthesis takes the place of a fragmentary knowledge or an analytical approach to truth. Consciousness, by the very experience which man has occasionally been able to record concerning it, is not something of particulars. Consciousness does not fill up the deficiencies of reason, nor does it necessarily bestow skill where aptitudes have not been properly cultivated. For the most part, consciousness is an impact of total value. And this impact is such that it can vitalize or sustain almost any kind of particular effort. We have no way of knowing whether what is termed the mystical experience differs with different types of persons. We wonder if the experience which comes to a scientist is different from that which comes to a monk in the desert. Is the mystical experience thereby conditioned to the intellectual background of the person receiving it? This seems doubtful for the reason that this experience is nearly always conferred under conditions which all classes of society have in common. For example, the businessman with the dying child has something in common with the prince of the realm with a dying child, or a savage in the jungle with a dying child. It is this common tragedy that unlocks something in the individual, which is a common denominator of conscious experience. It is not so much the particular attainments of the individual that seem to lure him toward the mystical consciousness experience. It is a common need, and a need for simple things that we all need. Einstein pointed out that the great mathematician is in just the same need for a simple consolation of spirit as the priest or the mystic. And if a mystical experience comes, it comes on the level of the need, not on the level of the attainment. It is therefore the common sorrow of man, the common stress of existence, the common hunger of hearts and souls that appears to be the thing that opens the door of conscious experience as distinguished from mental endeavor. For in most instances, this experience does not come until the possibility of mental satisfaction or condolence has been exhausted. It only comes when the individual can no longer find solace, either in thought or in reason. But breaking down into the simplest parts of his humanity strives after that which is the common consolation with all that lives. The sage, the saint, and the commoner are all united in these immediate pressing needs. And therefore, it is by the common denominator of such needs that consciousness, the common denominator of all life, symbolically reveals itself. Thus in consciousness, there is the bestowal of a certain kind of certainty. And we must ask ourselves just exactly what kind of certainty this is. We know it is not a theological certainty in the common sense of the word. It does not belong to a faith, for the mystical experience has occurred in all religions. It has therefore to do with the quality of believing rather than the creed. This is another example of how it breaks away from intellectualism. For many creeds are divided intellectually, but the soul hungers of human beings are not so easily divided. It is the hunger in the heart of man, the hunger of life, as Bailey calls it, the hunger of the creature for the Creator, that seems to be the final appetite by means of which the individual crosses into that causal kind of knowing which alone satisfies the hunger that food cannot reach. Man requiring this bread, which is not of this world, this bread, which is the food of the Spirit, gains his insight and consciousness by the hunger of his needing, rather than by the intellectual requirements of his mind. He is actually not searching for proof, for as one mystic points out, he was not seeking to justify God or to know that God existed or to prove God. He was simply seeking this peace which surpasseth understanding. He was seeking inevitably for this life, which is indeed the life of men, the life of conscious experience within. For without this, all is death. Once man has recognized the possibility of its attainment. So consciousness to these mystics is not something over which man may exercise any control. The hour of its coming, no man knoweth. For it entereth as a thief in the night. The individual cannot earn it exactly. He may merit it. He may deserve it. But its coming depends upon a basis of merit and desert beyond our estimation. And the mind which considers itself ready may be deceiving both itself and the heart. It is therefore in the readiness of the pure life in man that the experience comes, not in the justification by the mind or the emotions. In this experience, therefore, man's experience of consciousness is not that he becomes conscious, but rather that he enters into a subjective state of total worship. That he is suddenly aware of something that brings him to his knees, inwardly if not outwardly. He is not brought to his knees by terror or by fear, but by the awesomeness of that which is inevitably and eternally so. He enters into a highly receptive relationship. Suddenly, with all of his total life, his total being, he is able to say, not my will, but thine be done. Because in this case, his own will ceases to be of any value, any significance, or any importance. In fact, it is a detriment. It is part of that thing which has forced the mind against the wisdom of the heart. It is, therefore, the willlessness of the total acceptance in which the individual, opening himself, becomes entirely receptive to that which was, is, and ever shall be. Thus consciousness, moving into man, takes the place of man in his own nature. And this consciousness becomes a strange, ever-living sharing. It is that something by which a light from within, shining upon all other things, causes these other things to appear transparent, causes their inner parts to be as evident as their outer parts, but mostly transparent in their causes, in their spirits, and in the source and substance of their motivations. Thus, universal consciousness, as St. Francis of Assisi points out, bestows with it universal compassion. The individual ceases forever to judge, because judgment was a mind-judging life. This is audacity, only permissible while man knows no better. But with mind judges life and comes in with an unhappy verdict. Life judges life and comes in with a verdict of divine love and understanding. Life judging itself knows itself. Knows therefore its risings up and its settings down. Knows its increasing and its decreasing. And the life of the universe, being the love of God, knows the shortcoming, limitation, and frustration of all creatures that have not come to the light. Therefore, it passes judgment upon nothing, but rejoices in the light within all other things. And moving toward consciousness, moves towards a unity, in which there is no longer diversity and no longer mine or thine. Thus, in the mystical experience, all desire to pass judgment is lost. And the individual has this momentary flash of eternity, as described by Bamy as the lightning flash, which suddenly and instantly illumines all things, then passes, leaving a darkness. But that darkness can never forget the light. And that which is seen in the moment of light forever destroys man's fear of darkness. For in the moment he has seen what is in the darkness, and he has seen that it is good. And in this goodness is the end of all his fearing. Plotinus declares that on only a few occasions was he lifted up into the blessed experience of his God. But in those moments, he was as God. And being as God, he became as father, mother, child. He became parent and friend. He became leader and lover, all in one. And in the moments that followed these experiences, when life closed in again upon the mundane pattern of things, Plotinus said that these moments of eternity sustain the soul throughout the whole mystery of time. Once this experience has occurred, a man has the knowing and can say of inward things, "These I know." Against such an one, the shocks and arrows of outrageous fortune have no power or strength. And although the light itself may not continue to shine, man continues to know that it is there, separated from him only by the opacity of his own senses, and that wherever he sees darkness, it is merely because his eyes cannot bear the light that is behind the darkness. Thus in these experiences comes to man the courage or the strength to sustain him through the numerous vicissitudes in which material things close once more around him. But in these moments, he has experienced the fact of consciousness. More than this, he has experienced the fact of immortality. He has experienced the fact of God, of totality. And for a few seconds, he has been filled with that infinite love of life and love of God, which cannot be known on the sensory or emotional levels of man's external existence. Therefore, in those moments, his world is placed in order, in such an order that it can never again be shaken from that order. And in this, the opinions of others become meaningless. For his internal faith or knowing, this man may be persecuted and martyred, but he cannot be touched, because he lives in an inward, absolute participation in the fact of divinity. This, then, may be regarded as a negative definition, such as we are capable of fashioning out of the limited materials of ourselves, of this thing which we term consciousness. For consciousness is this wonderful power to actually be the other person, or to be the otherness of God in them. To come to this end, there are certain things that we naturally must attempt to do. All felicity must be deserved by man, for this universe is a merit system. Man must therefore come to the condition in which it is possible for him to accept such an experience, to merit it, to justly use it, and to need it, because there is within him already some resources which make it possible, and which will also assist the individual to preserve in honor this life which has been conferred upon him out of the universal abundance.
To attain this end, then, mystic philosophers, scientists of the past, and even those of the present, strive gently and unceasingly to achieve the likeness of consciousness so far as it is possible for them to attain it. They would discipline the mind, realizing that by such disciplining they reduce its negative forces and make it more and more like this consciousness which they desire. They feel, these mystics, that if their own natures become like a sanctuary, like a holy and sacred place, a garden of silence in a world of sounds, that if they prepare the temple according to the law, the living God will come and dwell in it. Thus, by purification, redemption of self, regeneration, dedication, and the serious, sincere, and honorable desire to self-improvement, man begins the slow but inevitable journey which will lead him through the mental life into the consciousness which is behind it. He must use first those faculties first available to him. But it is important in all of his philosophizing to recognize that aggressiveness, while it may seem a virtue in this world, is no virtue in terms of consciousness. On the other hand, weakness or negation is not a virtue. That in some way, in order to attain his divinity, man must suspend his humanity. He must in some way end this tyranny of mortality, not only in his body, but in his mind. In some strange way, the mystical experience revitalizes or renews the body of man and gives him greater insight and courage. It also renews his entire life in faith, giving him the skill to serve others more effectively because he is less selfish. Perhaps the one thing that the mystical experience tells us more than anything else is that it is the ultimate of spiritual revelation. And that as the ultimate of spiritual revelation, it cannot be communicated. From this we should learn that in our effort to communicate, we may, if we are not careful, overdo to the degree that we overemphasize in others the importance of communication. Certainly, everyone who wishes to know certain things must be exposed to them, must have some idea about them. Aquinas was problemed with the question, what can a teacher teach? And he answers it in a moderate way. Namely, that the teacher can teach the individual certain basic principles which will cause that individual to desire to grow of himself and by his own effort. But consciousness cannot be conferred. It must arise within the psychic spiritual life of the individual. Various inducements may assist man to live the life that will make the experience of consciousness likely. But motivation and every other factor must be correct. Therefore, I think we can say that indoctrination for purposes of the development of consciousness will generally prove ineffective. It is far more important that the individual attempt to cultivate vital experience within himself. And vital experience in this case is the dawning awareness through receptivity. On a practical level, then, it would seem important to follow the doctrines or the ideas of Lao Tzu, or perhaps certain of the teachings of Zen, in the search for the intensification of the experience factor. One reason why we experience so little is because we do not even permit the full penetration of our mental faculties into the things that we are doing. From the standpoint, therefore, of the vitalization of our lives, the ancients invented or devised the concept of contemplation, by means of which we devote or dedicate our attention to something with the desire, the simple and natural desire, to know and understand that thing better. Always recognizing that a relaxed receptivity to the messages of things cannot but result in increasing sensitivity within ourselves. The individual who can go forth, sit down quietly on the side of the mountain, and become receptive to the sunrise or the sunset, can be receptive to the motion of the wind across a field of ripening grain. Perhaps such receptivity enabled Vincent van Gogh to place a strange and luminous color into this field of grain, a color which other men did not see, but a color which Van Gogh, perhaps in his madness, was able to capture on canvas. But certainly, this motion of life in the air in the wheat field can be experienced. It can move in upon man. It can move in with the song of the bird and the evidence of life. It can come to us through the eyes of those we know and love. It can come in the simple voice and song of children. It can come in the sound of the great cathedral bell. It may come to us in every phase and experience of life if we learn to sit quietly and accept into ourselves the messages of things. If we are able to accept these messages without immediately conditioning them, if we can accept them as we accept air with gratitude, if we can take them as we would water because they are life to us, and not ask the name of the land from which the water came, what its beliefs were, or what its purpose might be, because this water is our life. If, therefore, we can accept the testimonies of things as a living breath of life moving into us, we can grow. We can find dimensions that are somewhat beyond the mind. We can say to the mind, be still. And in this stillness, we can accept the simple impact of life, the direct experience of living upon living. And through such experience, a new dimension comes to us, the contemplative dimension of receptivity. Perhaps the mind is still functioning, but it is doing so in a hallowed way. It is simply acting as a messenger. Through the sensory perceptions, it is telling us what we are seeing. It is not interpreting. Because our will and our purpose and our ego and our desires for the moment rest in sleep. And it is the sleeping of self-purpose that leads to the revelation of divine purpose. In these simple things, by learning to thoroughly examine, we begin to appreciate. For appreciation comes always in the footsteps of thoughtfulness. Things first disliked or neglected, when thoughtfully considered, create in us admiration and respect. The more we understand the workings of the universe as these workings are revealed to us in living things, the more we appreciate both the universe and the cause thereof. Appreciation, then, is a way of sharing. It is not really consciousness, but it is on the threshold of consciousness, where appreciation is a warming of ourselves, an opening up and a going forth in rejoicing to the sharing in some happy thought, pleasant contemplation, constructive reflection about things around us. If we are able thus to detach ourselves into this aloofness from personal desire and sentiment, there is no knowing, as Lao Tzu revealed, but that in some moment thus detached, we shall suddenly sense the opening of a universe of consciousness. We shall suddenly be picked up into this universal mystery of total awareness, total knowing, absolute certainty and validity, about which now we can only have words, and these not too effective. I think psychology must someday recognize this dimension also, that what lies at the root of our need is this need of common consciousness or experience, to be gained only by the overcoming of separateness as the dividing of our lives from all other lives. All things that are separate must die. All things that are united have a part in eternity, which is a state of union. Consequently, as long as we fight for individuality, we fight for death. We fight for aloneness, isolation, suffering. And we set up situations in which we will have grief and pain and sorrow. Nature allows this because out of breathing, out of pain, out of sorrow must come the incentives to overcome these things. For without such incentives, man might never even desire the truth, or might certainly never have the courage to place the search for it above every other consideration. But psychology must also realize that behind the mental phenomena of the individual is the universal phenomena of life itself. Mind as we know it is the shadow, the negative pole of consciousness. And the positive pole itself is locked in its own mystery. And whereas man must use the mind to think with, he must ultimately come to the point in which the mind must sacrifice itself for his salvation. This mind is like the ancient patriarch Moses, who was permitted to gaze upon the promised land. But because he had sinned against the laws of God, he was not permitted to enter into Canaan. And this right was withheld from him and bestowed upon Joshua, the son of Nun, who led the children of Israel to the land of milk and honey. Moses is the mind, which from the lonely height of Moab may contemplate the blessedness of truth, but may not enter in. That which can alone enter into this thing is the truth itself. Truth alone can know itself. Man cannot know this truth by any conscious action of his own will, but he can participate in it by simply permitting the spirit in himself to have dominion over the rest. For this spirit, of which he speaks and knows so little, is itself consciousness. It is an indivisible part of total experience. And because man participates in this spiritual fact, he can, by the stillness of his outer life, restore the luminosity of his internal. Thus reality arises in consciousness becoming aware of him, releasing itself into him. And in this consciousness, as Vivekananda points out, the great joy is that the individual no longer remains himself. Self-purpose ceases because it is meaningless in the beginning. The individual attains all by giving all, attains complete and perfect peace by becoming one with the infinite, and fulfills all desire by permitting universal desire to fulfill itself. through the faculties and powers which man has created. Thus, in the mystical experience, eternity takes control of man, his nerves, his muscles, his very body, takes control of his mind and his emotions. For the moment, man is eternity. And in that moment, there is impressed upon the fabric of his being a strange and indescribable experience. Later, this fabric cries out to give testimony to it. The mind seeks to explain. The emotions seek to interpret. But in their very explanation and interpretation, they defeat their own objective. For the only record is this strange impact upon the very substance of body itself. This strange, wonderful luminosity, which alone bears witness and which cannot be explained, except that the body is truly filled with light, a light which is itself filled with love and goodness. These experiences tell us something of a consciousness behind things. And when this consciousness takes hold, then perhaps the mind, among other servants, can bow down before it. And the mind, made divine by the life within it, may become a wonderful and useful instrument, may go forth to reveal the laws of eternity and the workings of time. Something like this happens in the case of the great composer. For the music which Schubert and Schumann heard within themselves, and which they record as having first realized as moving in the air about them, this music was captured by some dimension of consciousness. It was something that moved in upon them. They neither conjured it nor created it. They created a rapport with universal harmony and sound. And something out of their own psychic nature composed this strange harmony upon an instrument of universal tones. But once this experience was felt, once this strange haunting sound was captured, then the mind took over, reduced it to playable proportions, placed it upon a proper key, set it on paper, and made possible that it could be enlarged into a symphony or whatever the composition required. And out of technique and skill and wisdom, inspiration was made available in its most perfect form. Thus the personality, the mind, and the emotions become the servants of divine purpose. And man, having exchanged the uncertainties of his hopes and fears for the certainties of consciousness impact within himself, then finds his outward life unfolding in reverse. For instead of the outer molding the inner is molding the outer and expressing through it and releasing into the world those values and powers which we so greatly admire in those illumined souls whose contributions have earned our homage and admiration. In our own way, we must each pass through experiences of this kind, trying to gradually differentiate between consciousness as God life light in us and mind, which is the sum of our own struggle. Mind can help, but consciousness can save. And that which mind divides and wounds, consciousness shall unite and heal. For in all unit consciousness, total life, all good things come into their natural and inevitable works, and all which is divided or imperfect shall vanish away. And the individual, having experienced this, moves triumphantly along the way of life with perfect assurance within himself that he lives in a world of God and truth and light and love and wisdom. These things make his own labors possible and give him the infinite courage to continue according to those principles which he knows to be true.